To do occur. We are so frequently blinded by the smoke and the dust of the conflicts that rage about us that we fail to recognize the thing itself and to put these events in their proper perspective in the plan of God. There have been three startling developments in the last 36 years. Prophetic developments. And yet, I presume that we have failed to properly evaluate them. Reminds me somewhat of the story that is told of a farmer who went to his first circus, saw his first giraffe, and he looked at it, and he studied it for some 10 or 15 minutes, and then he turned away in disgust and said, "There ain't no such animal." That is the way with some of these events that we have been looking at. We say that there can't be no such thing. Yet it is true. These three events in the measure of their importance in some respects, at least their importance up to the present, is first, the spectacular and phenomenal rise of this United States of America in world affairs. Secondly, the fall of the House of Savoy, the Kingdom of Italy, the seventh head of the beast of the 17th chapter of Revelation, leaving it a headless beast, as it is to this day and will continue unto its end. Third, the birth of the nation of Israel. The fulfillment, in a literal sense, of the prophecy of the 66th chapter of Isaiah. You know, there are two Zions. There is a heavenly Zion and an earthly Zion. There is the spiritual house of Israel in which we are interested, the house of sons. There is the fleshly house of Israel, the house of servants. This house has given birth to a child before it travailed. The birth of the nation of Israel is the fulfillment of the prophecy. But after this birth, before she can bring forth her other children, she must travail. Jacob's trouble must yet afflict her. These other children are all the nations of the earth. All the families of the earth, more properly speaking. Yes, God promised unto Father Abraham that he would be the father of many nations. All the willing and obedient peoples of this earth, Jew and Gentile, are to be brought in to the fleshly seed of Abraham, into the fleshly house of Israel, under the terms of the new covenant, which he will shortly make with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. That new covenant has not yet been made. It cannot be made as long as the old law covenant is still in effect. It is still in effect and binding upon the fleshly house of Israel. Paul says, speaking of himself as a Jew and of other Jews, that Christ is the end of the law for righteousness unto all them that believe. He is not the end of the law for righteousness unto the Gentiles. The Gentiles have never been under the law. And any righteousness to which they may attain must come from the same source and in the same way in which righteousness comes also to the believing Jew. That is a fundamental principle in God's dealings with his people by faith during this gospel age. That covenant is to be made, the new covenant, with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. It is yet awaiting the completion of the Messiah, head and body, or the mediator. It is yet awaiting the completion of the priesthood of that covenant. It is yet awaiting the completion of the better sacrifices upon which it will be based, the sacrifices of the Christ, head and body. And until that is true, that new covenant cannot be sealed, made effective and binding, and set in operation. Yes, we are living in important days. I want to call your attention to a prophecy, one treated in the reprint in the Powers of many years ago. The 18th chapter of Isaiah. Woe to the land shadowing with wings, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia. This prophecy, like all prophecy, is figurative, symbolic. You know, prophecy primarily was addressed to the fleshly house of Israel. Doubtless the prophet Isaiah thought, well, these words apply to the children of Israel, to whom I am speaking. And they did, in a sense. And he must have wondered at the language which the Spirit of God moving him prompted him to employ. The exaggerations which existed in that language, which could not always fit into the experience of the fleshly house of Israel. No, the Lord, looking far beyond that time and that people, saw the spiritual house of Israel and was speaking unto them as well as unto the fleshly house. And this is an illustration of it. You know, all prophecy is focused largely upon two geographical points, the city of Rome and the city of Jerusalem, upon two geographical territories, the territory of the old Roman Empire and the territory of the promised land of Palestine of Israel. Other peoples and nations on this earth come into the picture only as they have been drawn into the picture and the great whirlpool of political events that has now literally sucked all nations and peoples into the day and into the period of the Lord's wrath. So, this is figurative language. The word woe here is a mistranslation. It is not a declaration, it is a salutation. Read Young's translation, read Leifer's translation, and others. Ho to the land tattered with wings that lies beyond the rivers of Ethiopia. You know, Ethiopia said to them the ends of the earth. It was a general term applied to the continent of Africa. In the days of Peleg, we are told, the earth was divided. In other words, the time came, as men began to multiply upon the earth, it became necessary to do something about the increasing hazards of the situation. They were all concentrated largely in the valleys of the Tigris and Euphrates River, some overflowing down into the Arabian Peninsula, from westward over to the Mediterranean Sea, others eastward to the border of India, north to the Black and the Caspian Sea. But that territory, large as it was, would not be large enough for the multitudes and the millions that were in prospect ahead in the centuries that were to come. So evidently the patriarchs, under divine providence, were called together to consider the situation. And Peleg was born at that time, the time of this conference. It says he was named Peleg, which means division, because in his day the earth was divided. Seemingly the children of Ham were given the continent of Africa, the children of Shem, the continent of Asia, the children of Japheth, the continent of Europe. The Western Hemisphere was left wide open, and mankind was largely hindered from colonizing it, although some colonizing efforts were made. The Western Hemisphere was well known to that ancient world. Indeed, 1,000 years B.C., exploratory colonies were settled in Central America, Peru, Colombia, and North South America became peopled in time by these lost colonies of the Phoenicians. The Incas, the Aztecs, and the Toltecs, other texts, if there were any, are the descendants of those lost colonies of the ancient Phoenician traders. The connection seemed to be quite definitely established in our time. Yes, here was a land beyond the ends of the inhabited world. Saluted, ho to that land shattered with wings. You know, Bible symbology and figures are remarkable in their accuracy. For instance, you recall when the Lord gave Daniel a vision of the kingdoms which Nebuchadnezzar saw under the figure of a man, he showed him four great beasts coming up out of the sea. Four great winds, it says, strove upon that sea. Four great wars for the conquering of other peoples. Four beasts diverse one from the other. First, like a lion with four wings. Second, like a bear, raising itself on one side and having three ribs in its mouth. The third, like unto a leopard, with four heads and four wings. And the fourth, a beast exceedingly great and terrible. No analogy for it in all the brute creation. The prophet could only describe it with this great and ugly mouth, in which were set ugly, jagged teeth, and his head with ten horns. And as he watched, a peculiar horn came up among the ten. That peculiar horn had eyes and a mouth, just one mouth, which spake great swelling words. And it plucked up three of the other horns and cast them to the ground. But its body and its tail stretched forth northward and eastward over the continent of Europe and part of Asia Minor. You know, the territory of these four empires roughly outlined the figures or images of the beast. Look it up at your leisure. Some years ago, there was a publication put out called A Finished Mystery. Well, it didn't finish any mystery, but it very nearly finished the Lord's people. On the back of a special edition of this was a drawing of these four beasts outlining their territory. And that fourth beast, the territory occupied by Rome, fitted in as a horrible beast. The mouth was the Mediterranean Sea, the upper jaw the shores of Asia, and the lower jaw the shores of North Africa. And those teeth and air was Italy and Greece, another promontory. Yes, it was an ugly beast. History demonstrated its ugliness. Then later, Daniel had some other visions. Remember, he saw a he-goat with a single horn. And he saw a ram with two horns. And when that he-goat saw that ram, it was filled with anger. And it rushed upon it and destroyed it and trampled it into the earth. But in the height of its victory, that horn was broken. And four horns came up in its place. And remember, we are told by Daniel, the Lord in interpreting that to him, that he-goat was Greece, another figure in which Greece appeared. And the ram was Persia, represented in the other figure by a bear. Well, it is historical fact that in the days of Alexander the Great and Artaxerxes, the emblem upon the banners of the Persian army was a ram with its two horns. And the emblem upon the banner of Alexander the Great was a he-goat with a single horn, which was Alexander himself. He was proud of that horn, although ultimately it was broken after one of the most marvelous campaigns in all army history, the 12 years in which he conquered the earth and sat down by the moaning sea and wept because there was no people left to conquer. And in the height of his victory, he died in a drunken revelry. Yes, there is a remarkable aptness in the symbology of the Bible. In fact, the word Aegean, applied to the Aegean Islands and the Aegean Sea off Greece, means goat. So the emblem of the goat still pertains to Greece to this very day. And you remember, too, it was under the Roman eagles that Rome conquered the world. And the eagle was the symbol of the Roman Republic and the triumvirate and the Caesars of the Julian House. But after the last one of the Caesars of the Julian House, gradually another symbol was introduced. And in the second century, it supplanted, in the close of the second century, in the beginning of the third, it supplanted the Roman eagles, under which symbol Rome conquered the world. It was the symbol of the great red dragon. And how appropriate it was that at that time, that the Revelator, speaking of that particular time and change, should represent Rome, the civil power of pagan Rome, as a great red dragon. And in the days of Constantine, it reached its zenith of power and influence. So it's here, it is spoken of, a land, a people, as a land shattered with wings. It refers to the Western Hemisphere. It refers to a particular part of the Western Hemisphere and to a nation that would arise, the most powerful in every respect that this world has ever seen. Land shadowed with the wings of the American eagle. And yet there is a topographical significance here. You know, if you put the body of a bird at the Panama Canal, the outline of the continents of South and North America, roughly, resembles that of a bird. It's a hemisphere shadowed with wings. And this old bird, the American eagle, has taken the whole hemisphere under its wings today, for some, to them, unknown reason. Notice what follows the salutation. That sendeth ambassadors by the sea in vessels of bulrushes upon the water, saying, go ye swift messengers to a nation scattered in fields, to a people terrible from their beginning hitherto, a nation meted out and trodden down, whose lands the rivers have spoiled. These are highly symbolical words, simple though they appear, as used in the text. That sendeth ambassadors in vessels of bulrushes. You ever see any vessel made out of bulrushes upon the sea? It becomes apparent at once that this must be figurative. You know, bulrushes, papyrus, was the source of the ancient paper, a papyrus, on which they inscribe their records of those days. Vessels of paper saying, "Go," Young's translation reads and others, "Go, ye messengers of life." The Lord held back this continent for centuries. And finally, when the due time came, it was opened up to immigration to the oppressed peoples of the continent of Europe and elsewhere. You know, the message of God had to be preached to all peoples, nations, languages, and tongues. That was what was told in the 10th chapter of Revelation. "You shall preach again unto kings and nations and people." The message of the Adventist movement just a generation before went unto all Europe and large parts of the world. You know, there were two ways to accomplish this. The Lord could have built up a great organization of educated, trained men and women, and versed in all the different languages of the globe, and sent them as missionaries to all the globe in order to preach the message of present truth. But there was another easier process, more economical one, and that was to bring all nations, languages, and people to a common center, to a common territory, and there, in a common language, to present the truth to them. And that's what happened. These United States of America have been highly favored of God and blessed of Him as being the center of the proclamation of what we call the harvest message present truth. And as long as it maintains its Republican status, and as long as it refrains and heeded the advice of its founding fathers to enter into no entangling alliances with the peoples of the rest of the world, especially the continent of Europe, it had the blessings of God and prospered mightily. Yes, the message of light was to go to a people, to a nation scattered, or a people scattered and peeled. To a people terrible from their beginning hitherto, a nation, a people meted out and trodden down, whose lands the rivers have spoiled. All symbolical. Who is this people scattered and peeled, to whom the messages of life are to go? The Lord. They have been peeled, if they have made a proper consecration to the Lord, of all their earthly possessions, of everything that they are and have as human beings. Not literally, but through the covenant that they made with the Lord by sacrifice. You know, when you made this covenant with the Lord, you surrendered your right to everything that you had, even the clothes on your back. They don't belong to you any longer. They belong to the Lord. But of course, He doesn't need them. Besides, they might not fit. And He turns them back to you. You surrendered your home to Him. But He doesn't need that. He's got a better one of His own. He turns it back to you. And you gave up your job to Him. He doesn't need that. He's got a better job of His own. So He turns your job back to you. But He said, "Now remember, henceforth, they're not yours, they're mine." What kind of a workman do you think I'd make if I was literally on your job. That's the kind of a workman I expect you to be. What kind of a home do you think I'd run? I was the head of your house. Well, I am. But I'm turning the headship back to you. What kind of a head of the house do you think I'd make? What kind of a husband do you think I'd make? What kind of a wife do you think I'd make? Henceforth, you represent me in all this. Yes, we could go into great detail on this. The word parable is a crude mistranslation. The word of the Hebrew is the equivalent of our word revere. A reverential people. A people full of reverence to God. Whose inheritance has been measured out. Meted means to measure. Yes, everything that we have, all the hopes we have, all the prospects before, are measured, limited by divine providence, by the plan of God. And the rivers have often spoiled, interfered with these matters. Remember, the third vial was poured out upon the rivers and fountains of waters. And the prophet Jeremiah gives us somewhat of a clue to this when he represents the Lord as addressing Israel and saying, you have committed two sins. First, you have rejected me, the fountain of water, and you have built yourself cisterns, broken cisterns that hold no water. Yes. The rivers and fountains of water. The third plague was poured out upon them. That's not for us to consider now. All ye inhabitants of the world and dwellers on the earth, see ye when he lifted up an ensign upon the mountain. When he bloweth the trumpet, hear ye. Yes, the lifting up of the ensign, sign of truth. The blowing of the seventh trumpet has been from our shores to all the world and to the Lord's people within our shores and to all the world. So the Lord said unto me, I will take my rest and I will consider in my dwelling place like a clear heat upon earth's herb and like a cloud of dew in the heat of the harvest. I'm reminded right here of the words of Moses in the 32nd chapter of Deuteronomy. My doctrine, my teaching shall distill as the dew. They will come down as the gentle rain upon the tender grass. Yes, the teachings of the Lord, like the cloud of dew in the heat of the harvest. Yes, some you remember the parable of the vineyard worker. During the heat of the day. For before the harvest, when the bud is perfect, before the harvest is finished, when the bud is perfect, and the sour grape is ripening, and the flower, he shall both cut off the sprigs with pruning hooks, and take away and cut down the branches. You know, I like Leeser's translation here. It reads, for before the harvest is ended, when the blossom is past and the flower becomes a ripening grape, will he both cut off the tendrils with pruning knives and the sprigs will he remove and cut down? Yes, every branch in me that beareth not fruit, etc., you remember. They shall be left together unto the fowls of the mountain and to the beasts of the earth, and the fowls shall summer upon them, and all the beasts of the earth shall winter upon them. That reminds me of the 19th chapter of Revelation, and we'll refer to it a little later. There are other references, apparently, to be far off shores, so far removed from the continents of the old Eastern Hemisphere. And I want to read a few verses from the 8th chapter of Isaiah. Here we read from Fenton's translation. Fenton is perhaps the greatest Hebrew scholar that the English-speaking race has produced. His translation is a highbrow translation. If you don't know the English language, it might be confusing. And many of us don't, even though we profess to speak it. The 9th verse of the 8th chapter. Collect together, you nations, but you shall be broken. Listen, lands at a distance. This is introducing another factor. Arm yourselves, but you shall be broken. Arm yourselves, but you shall be broken. Decide a united scheme. Discuss a plan. It shall not succeed. What are these lands at a distance? Far distance from the Eastern Hemisphere, the continents of Europe, of Africa, and of Asia. Why, evidently, these words prophetically are addressed to these United States, and they fit the picture since 1914. Collect together your nations. What a collecting of nations there was in existence in 1914. And what disaster happened to those collections of nations? The Entente and the alliances of Europe. But you shall be broken. And they were. Listen, lands at a distance, arm yourselves, and you shall be broken. Twice, again, arm yourselves, but you shall be broken. This nation, as I knew it as a boy, was very, very far from a military nation. Our army was almost the laughter of the world. Never in all our history of a century and a half have we ever been prepared for a war. And in all that century and a half, we never lost a war. Why? It was a land shattered with wings, protected by divine providence. And if history teaches us one lesson more than another, it is this, that no nation prepared for war ever won a war. They may have won the battle to begin with. But their victory was their defeat. Wars are punishment for sin upon peoples and nations. That is always true, as they are manipulated by divine providence in the affairs of men. Yes, but what a change came in 1914 and later. With what feverish haste and waste of will, we armed ourselves. I remember the slogan of that first World War, to make the world safe for democracy. And there has never been less democracy in this world. And since that war ended, and again, the command went forth, arm yourselves to the very teeth. We armed ourselves. This time under the slogan, a war to end war. The war that was fought to end wars has not ended to this day, either hot or cold. Yes, armed to the teeth. We have just lost the only war we've ever lost in our history. A bitter, bitter defeat. Against what we were told was a helpless enemy that would be thrashed in just a few short weeks. Arm yourselves and you shall be broken. Discuss a plan. Yes, advocate a League of Nations. Will not succeed. Formulate and subsidize a United Nations scheme. It shall not succeed. All you have to do is to look there at the United Nations and New York today to realize the fact that if and all the world has seemingly lost the cohesive element that once held this world together and the nation. Yes, there are other prophecies. You won't take time to notice them. I want to call your attention to the book of Revelation. We're fulfilling prophecies as outlined by the Revelator. To the 13th chapter of Revelation. John says, I stood upon the sand of the seashore, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And he describes this beast, a composite beast. The beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet was as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power and feet and great authority. You remember those four beasts we referred to in Daniel's vision? Sure, they all are in one. Why is such a picture furnished us? Evidently for this reason, that we would be able to recognize the fact that while the pagan Roman Empire ended, the Roman Empire itself didn't end. And it was the entire Gentile power represented in the four beasts was the continual, represented in this composite beast, down until 1914. Yes, Rome was first pagan. Then it became Christian under Constantine, allegedly Christian. Then, 3 centuries later, about, it became papal. And as papacy, it has continued to this hour, to 1914, and decreasingly in power and authority unto this present time. You know, most Bible students have a very vague idea or understanding of the papacy and of the Roman Catholic Church. They think that they are both one and the same thing. They are not one and the same thing by any means. And the Bible makes a distinction between the Roman Catholic Church and the papacy. The Catholic Church lasted for 300 years before it was Romanized. It lasted for another 200 or more years before it was re-paganized under papacy. It was at the Council of Nicaea that the man of sin was begotten. It was at the Edict of Justinian in 539 that that man begotten, gestating all these centuries, was born, and the midwife was Emperor Justinian and the Bishop of Rome at that day. The Catholic Church lasted for 300 years before it was Romanized. It lasted for another 200 or more years before it was re-paganized under papacy. It was at the Council of Nicaea that the man of sin was begotten. It was at the Edict of Justinian in 539 that man begotten, gestating all these centuries, was born, and the midwife was Emperor Justinian and the Bishop of Rome at that day. It took it another 300 years nearly before it became a full matured man of sin and mystery of iniquity, when in 799, Pepin and Charlemagne his son confirmed the gift and established the Bishop of Rome in civil authority over the 10 papal states in central Italy, which authority he continued to exercise during the whole of the papal millennium, with a few brief interruptions, down to 1799, the counterfeit reign of Christ. Read your history. No, the Roman Catholic Church is one thing. Papacy, one of the seven heads of the beast, is quite another thing. God has never considered papacy as a religious system, even though it is represented as using as its handmaid the Roman Catholic Church, a harlot and the mother of harlots. Papacy is not a harlot, it's a man. We've got to make the distinctions in this matter that the Lord makes. Yes, we briefly traced that history. Then you notice John saw another beast coming up out of the earth. Papacy as the man of sin, and the Roman state under its control for many centuries as one of the seven heads of the beast, the Roman beast. You know, a head is the intelligent part of a creature that directs his body. So these seven heads had 10 horns, and on the horns, 10 crowns. Later, in the 17th chapter, you have a scarlet-colored beast for the names of blasphemy. 7 heads and 10 horns and no crown. So this was the time pictured in the 13th chapter when those horns reigned with the beast, when they had crowns. We have to get that matter straight before our minds are sorted. But here's another beast coming up out of the earth, out of an orderly process of growth and development, not taking advantage to increase of revolution and weakness in the decadent old Roman Empire, as papacy did. This two-horned beast, as Brother Russell points out, is the kingdom of Great Britain. The history of Britain is unique and interesting. It has been the history of a people developing to its zenith, which it passed a few decades ago, through a gradual, orderly process. Sometimes in that history, Rome succeeded in infiltrating into Britain and into the government and the religious system of Britain, but always only temporarily. Time after time she was cast out. Until finally, under Elizabeth I, she was thrown out bag and baggage. And the Protestant Reformation movement in Britain was consolidated and established upon a firm foundation. Yes, this two-horned beast is Britain. Until 1846, the established churches of Britain was the English church and the Irish church. In 1846, the Irish church was disestablished. It had come too greatly under the power and influence of papacy. And therefore, it was disassociated with the British government. Notice that this two-horned beast commanded that an image should be made to the original beast, papacy. And this image has been puzzling Bible students for many years. Whole volumes have been written on it, all of which will shortly have to be thrown away. Yes, the whole libraries that have come into existence on Revelation will shortly have to be all discarded, for they are all wrong. And Brother Russell knew that was coming. I talked with him in March 1914. I asked him about the promised seventh volume. He says, Brother Baker, I don't know if there ever will be a seventh volume. He said, when I first began to write, I thought I was going to get everything in one volume, and it took three. He says, after I had published the three, and a few years later, I saw there were other matters that would have to be treated topically and presented to the church. He says, naturally, the number seven came into my mind. I've held in reservation a possible seventh volume for an explanation of Revelation. But it says there's some things there I don't understand. I don't know whether I ever will understand. If I never understand them, there'll never be a seventh volume. I asked him, I said, well, evidently there are some things you do understand. He says, yes. Well, I said, why don't you explain to us the things that you understand? Listen to his answer. It amazed me. He says, no. If I were to do that, friends would try to fill in between, and they'd get in trouble. Well, when he died, what did they do? They went back and they picked up interpretations that he had discarded, never referred to again. And they filled in between, and they got in trouble. That's what he foresaw. Yes? This word image is from the Greek word icon. An icon is not necessarily an idol. An idol is not an icon. There are two Greek words, one for idol and one for icon. An icon is a replica or an image of a person. That's why they call the statuary, and particularly in the Greek church, of Jesus and the apostles and Mary and so on, an icon. Did you notice in the paper today, the Pope has just decreed the year 1954, the Marian year, in which Diana of the Ephesians will be exalted in all the earth and every Catholic diocese. It's a tragic declaration. Maybe it's the one coming as it does, right on time, that may help seal the fate of that abomination of the earth. Papacy, Romanism, all her harlot daughters' death. Yes, to make an image of the beast. What beast? Papal beast. To make an image of the man of sin. A likeness to it. A replica of the man of sin. And now let us note from history, I think, that rather familiar to you. You read your volume 3 and 4 recently. In 1846, there was set up in London, England, by the evangelical churches, what is called the Evangelical Alliance, an alliance of the evangelical Protestant churches, in order to head off the splitting and divisions that were going on in these churches, and to centralize authority in a theological code. And they did. And they included in that code the old errors of papacy, the Trinity, paganism, the pagan God, immortality of the soul, again, pagan philosophy. And of course, if the soul was immortal, it had to go somewhere. And they incorporated the pagan concept of the future. Hell, and ultimately, they didn't in the Evangelical Alliance, all they had was hell. They didn't even, by the way, put in limbo or purgatory. But at the same time, the thought was there. Well, there was no place on the continent of Europe for the rise of this power. There was no place in the British Isles for it to arise. For if it was to be a replica, ultimately, of the man of sense, that was just the begetting of another man. And a long period of years of gestation followed before it could be born. Just as a long period of gestation in the man of sin, before it could be born, the man's child to be caught up to God and to his throne. Show himself in the temple of God as God was born. As Paul describes it. But there it was conceived. It was moved to the United States. And here it has appeared for some years under the Council of the Churches of Christ of America. With the First World War, it was born. And there began the establishment of the image of life. For the image with life is subsequently referred to as the false prophet. Masculine gender. The false prophet. And in order to be a replica, an icon, the civil power and voice must be dominant in this image. And the religious elements must be subordinated to us. And just as papacy, a man of sin, speaking in the words of the street, slept with the religious institutions, well, she was married to him. He had a right to that. But you know, in these our times, many a woman lives with a man without being married to him. And that is true of these Protestant churches and the Roman part of the Roman church in these United States. Since 1914 and 16, they have been allied with the political and military power in this country. And they have danced to the tune of the fiddler of the military and political powers. There has been a tacit alliance of church and state. And if you don't believe it, go down to Washington, D.C. and study the situation there for a few weeks. And you'll be convinced of the fact that there is an open alliance today between the military and the politicians and the churches of this country. Otherwise, men like McCarthy and Jenner and some others wouldn't be tolerated for 24 hours. They wouldn't have been in this country when I was a boy. Yes, this is a decadent democracy, shot through and through with the virus of hypocrisy, of sham, and of fraud. And today is surely and rapidly dissolving into anarchy. The next phase of the time of trouble. Yes, the false prophet and the man of sin stand together in a common cause facing a common enemy before whom they are fearful of a common defeat. And little do they know what the real forces are and factors behind the swiftly developing and changing events in the affairs of this world. Notice the 19th chapter of Revelation. It's in process of fulfillment today. One upon a white horse, out of whose mouth goeth a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations. In the first chapter, that one likened to the Son of Man among the seven candlesticks is said to have a sharp sword going out of his mouth, a two-edged sword. Literally, in the Greek, it is a two-mouthed sword going out of his mouth. And here the same sword is referred to, the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. With it, he is to slay the nation. That reminds us of his words when he said, "Bring hither mine enemies and slay them before me." You know, there are two ways to slay an enemy. Cut his throat, or to convert him into a friend. And we would understand in its last analysis that this latter is the process the Lord will shortly use. He shall rule them with a rod of iron, and he treadeth the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. The winepress, then the process of being trodden, lo, these many years. And then he goes on to describe an angel standing in the sun and cried with a loud voice to all the fowls that fly in the heavens, in the midst of heaven. And you know, we're told in the 18th chapter that Babylon has become the cage of every unclean and hateful bird and every foul spirit and the home of demons. These pictures are consistent. Yes, someone standing in the light of the gospel sun of the gospel message proclaimed this, appealing to the radical elements of the world, telling them, this is your day. Go up the sea. Take a spoil. Rob, plunder. Does it take you long to identify that element whom the Lord spewed out of his mouth not so many years ago, and who in his name presumptuously dare to say that they represent him and his spirit of truth? I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gather together to make war against him that sits on the horse and against his army. This is the new heavens taking control. The Lord, him upon the horse, with others upon horses, in the heavens. And the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him. All the time that this false prophet had been developing, closer and closer had been the relations and ties, political, military, and otherwise, financial, between the two-horned beast and its offspring, the United States of America. Until today, they are closely allied, until the officials on both sides admit that if one falls, the other must fall with it. Yes, the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image. These both were cast alive in the lake of fire, burning with brimstone. Brother Russell, in one comment upon this, says, in this picture, the lake of fire represents anarchy. Anarchy. And that is where we are headed. There'll be no revolution in this country. We are faced today, within a very, very short period, with a military dictatorship. Everything is prepared to spring it overnight on the American people, binding them hand and foot. And your rights and liberties